And is the light of the world, but lights need to be connected to a source so that they don't burn out. And with that in mind, there's a red Mercury 2YEY 849 with its lights on. What's it's really wonderful to be here this morning. Thank you all so much. I think I can say on behalf of the other missionaries here this weekend, thank you for bringing us back. Thank you for loving us. And so my wife and my boys and our church back in Croatia sends you their greetings as well. And I'm really thankful. A lot of people have told me that they're praying for me today because I was very intimidated to take on the topic of this sermon to talk about evangelism. I've sat through a lot of sermons in my life on evangelism that clearly communicate a lot of disappointment with Christians for not doing enough and not being active enough. And I wonder if you're wary of the same thing. But my hope today is that God will make you curious to take another look at your own view of evangelism and excite you about what he's already doing through you and new things he might do. I have been profoundly blessed because of evangelism. My sister Allison was a freshman at Stanford when someone did a spiritual interest survey with her in the dinner line and followed it up with a visit to her dorm room. So a young missionary shared the gospel with her using the four spiritual laws. She prayed to trust Christ and immediately was struck by the following thought. She was frustrated. She thought, how is it that I've been going to church my entire life and no one explained to me that this is the point of it all? She started to share with me during her school breaks. In fact, I think Senya Wong was in a Bible study with her that prayed for me when I was in high school before I came out to college. And by the time I got out here for college, I was really intrigued to get involved with both her church, Peninsula Bible Church, and the ministry she was a part of at Stanford Campus Crusade for Christ. And God used those days to change the course of my life. And I would not be married to my wife, Sandra, if it was not for the fruit of bold initiative evangelism. Young college students went to Zagreb, Croatia in 1992, right in the middle of the war, of the collapse of Yugoslavia, to share the gospel with university students. One student they met, Sasha, was a bit afraid of these strange foreign guys that he'd met, but he agreed to meet them again. But he begged his friend Domogoy, who spoke really excellent English, to come along with him. Domogoy heard that this American guy was from Seattle, and back then grunge was all the rage, and so he thought, oh, this will be great. I'll have my chance to hear all about grunge from a real local. Of course, this good Christian boy knew next to nothing about grunge. And Domogoy thought, oh, we'll just get the God talk out of the way and I can ask him about grunge. But somehow Domogoy ended up accepting the offer to come to a Jesus film showing shortly after that. Went to it again with Sasha and brought his girlfriend Biana along, and to his own shock found himself standing at the end of the film and saying he wanted to trust Christ with his life. Biana, his girlfriend was in shock, and but herself a couple weeks later came to Christ from a totally atheistic background. Very shortly after that, Biana was walking down the street and ran into her best friend from high school. Things were so chaotic in Croatia during the war that she had lost track of her best friend from high school and hadn't seen her in 2 years. And they sat down on a park bench and talked for 2 hours. And her best friend, Sandra, was elated to find someone safe that she could share about all the crazy things that were going on with her own family, but shocked to find out that her best friend, Biana, had recently joined a sect. So Sandra spent 6 months studying the Bible to prove it wrong, and it didn't work very well. And she herself became a Christian, and we met 3 years later doing missions work. And yet, evangelism can be extremely controversial. Christians are rarely more sharply critical of one another than when it comes to efforts to share the gospel. And that fault line ran down the middle of my own early Christian life, growing up both in this church and in Campus Crusade. Here at PBC, I heard the importance of our identity in Christ and the way that our identity has to be the source of our actions. So I heard a lot of concern that a lot of Christian activity, including evangelism, gets motivated by guilt. Meanwhile, in Campus Crusade, I was offered incredible opportunities to be active in my faith and be stretched. And I did a lot of evangelism, always with fear, usually thinking of something I should have said 20 minutes after the conversation was over, and sometimes seeing God do really amazing stuff. I also heard a lot of complaints from that side that the average Christian isn't doing enough and doesn't know what they're doing in presenting the gospel. And so what I have learned comes from struggling with understanding what we are doing when we share our faith. I'm not going to give you a bunch of stories about leading people to Christ on airplanes and other forms of public transportation. I'm actually pretty weak in that area, but I am part of a band of people that gets up every day and gives their lives away to make Christ known in a difficult environment where few people respond. Working out a proper understanding of and love for preaching the gospel for me began years ago when, to my fascination and horror, someone pointed out to me that no one in the New Testament gets criticized for not sharing their faith enough. And Paul himself never gave a challenge to his churches to do more evangelism. As the missions thinker Leslie Newbegin put it, one searches in vain through the letters of St. Paul to find any suggestion that he anywhere lays it on the conscience of his hearers that they ought to be active in mission. And yet, though Paul was silent on exhorting others to a missionary duty, he could not conceive of being silent himself. Understanding his heart, I think, can transform our understanding of the place of evangelism in our lives. And we desperately need to better understand his heart, I think, living in an era that looks more and more like his, where culture has shifted and a traditional understanding of evangelism, let's say in 20th century America, has really kind of reached a breaking point. So first we'll see in 1 Corinthians 9 that Paul's motivation for an understanding of evangelism is different from, in subtle but important ways, from the way we often talk about it. Then I'll briefly talk about how the growth of the early church was fueled by the same kind of understanding that Paul had. And lastly, I'll give some suggestions about what this means for us today. So please turn with me to 1 Corinthians 9, which, if we still have pew Bibles that are consistent, was on page 1134 in the one that I looked at. I'm going to read verses 11 through 18. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? But we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in what is offered on the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. But I have not used any of these rights, and I am not writing this in the hope that you will do such things for me. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of this boast. Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach the gospel voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge and so not make use of my rights in preaching it. Well, this drops us right in the middle of a complex argument that Paul is making, so allow me to give some background. The church in Corinth was young, excited, and full of problems. It had controversy, scandal, and factions. And after Paul founded the church and built it up, he moved on, and criticism of him arose. What kind of teacher works with his hands? And what kind of community can submit itself to the leadership of a common laborer? The ancient world was incredibly sensitive to questions of honor and position. So Paul goes out of his way to confirm that if honor is due anyone, it is due to those who preach the gospel. But then he insists that he did not and will not accept financial help from the Corinthian church, even though he clearly did from other churches and at other times. So what was at stake for Paul in not accepting and refusing financial help from the Corinthians? Well, one thing is that in a church containing both poor and wealthy people, the financial support would have ended up coming overwhelmingly from the most wealthy and socially dominant Christians. In the ancient world, one of the most fundamental building blocks of society was something called the patron-client system. Accepting support from wealthy Corinthians would have naturally put Paul in the position of a client to a rich patron. And when patrons called the tune, clients played. Paul would not allow his ministry to fall under the sway or even the appearance of such a powerful system. Also, Paul lived in a cynical age that saw oratory as something that skilled speakers used fine but empty words in order to kind of wheedle their way into a job for themselves. So Paul was willing to go to extreme lengths to make sure that the light of Christ was not dimmed by or confused for anything else. And so, as is so often the case with Paul, he takes a practical issue to open a door to far deeper truths. He moves from explaining and defending his financial donor policy to a series of very deep personal statements about his determination to share the gospel and his disciplined flexibility in doing so. And so this is what we're going to see in this passage. Paul was overwhelmed by the person of Christ, and that made him incredibly tenacious. We tend to look for charisma and skill in leaders and appreciate them based on short-term success. But Paul's distinguishing characteristic was his ability to suffer for the cause while leading a holy life. We want to boil things down to principles out of which we can live secure and controlled lives. But in Paul's mind, the risen Christ was always personal, immediate, and beautiful. We tend to want simple, easy programs to see people come to Christ, but Paul disciplined himself to be always crossing barriers and reaching towards those who are far away from the gospel. There are two phrases in what the passage that I read that stand out in expressing his tenacity. The first is in verse 12. He and his band put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. So the relative weight of the good of anything next to the good of the gospel for Paul is zero. In contrast, we live in an age when everything is supposed to have a dollar sign value attached to it. But as soon as something has a price, it's exchangeable for something else. One of the most popular and overused words in business these days is leverage. A good manager is supposed to leverage what he has in order to get more of something else. But leverage really means stretching or risking or exchanging something in the service of something else. But Paul admits no horse trading of the gospel for other goals, no mutual back scratching with other causes, no thinking win-win of the gospel and some other good. Anything that even appears to draw it into question is just not worth doing. The second phrase that shows his tenacity is in verse 16. I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. This is a challenging statement. Paul, the apostle of the heart set free, the author of the charter of Christian freedom, the champion of grace, this very man says, I am compelled to preach. How does that work? And he even goes on to make this statement that seems to say that in preaching the gospel, he is merely discharging a duty, as if being the greatest preacher ever doesn't get him any points. He has to do it in for free in order to sort of get some kind of a reward. What is he talking about? Well, I hope to make you today a little bit more intrigued about Paul as a person. Liberal Protestantism has always been completely embarrassed by him, and I think that over time, some of that has spilled over into evangelicals as well. We love his lofty theology, but we really don't like to talk all that much about his personality. His cranky cajoling, his talk about boasting, his awkward way of disclosing himself. But over the last 9 years as a faltering missionary myself, Paul has become so alive to me. He's become a great mentor, and I'd even say a friend. And I would have loved to be the water boy on his team. To understand him is to understand that the day he became a Christian was the best and the worst day of his life. His Christian life started with a cataclysm, strolling down the road to round up and kill or imprison the next bunch of Christians, incredibly knowledgeable about God's law. He was knocked down to the dirt and found out he was the most wrong man in the Roman Empire. He immediately started to have to learn from and submit to the very people he had despised. Imagine this, if right after he became a Christian, someone had come up to you and said this, hey, did you hear there's a word from the Lord about you? Hey, great, let me hear it. You are the Lord's chosen instrument to carry his name before both Gentiles and Israelites. Ooh, but there's a little bit more. I don't know what this part's about. The Lord is going to have to show you how much you must suffer for his name. And that's what he got. Paul felt like he didn't even deserve to be called an apostle because he persecuted the church. When Christ blew up Paul's life, it was an explosion of joy. But a lot of us can relate to such a complete break only by thinking about tragedies. Tragedies are things you just never quite get over. You never quite get back to normal after a tragedy. You have to find a new normal. And Paul never got over his experience of meeting Christ. His new normal continually reflected Christ's invasion of his life. So Paul is not serving Christ out of what we would call guilt. He's just totally bowled over by Jesus, and that makes him incredibly determined. An example for me that captures this kind of determination that's born out of relationship comes from the 90s movie Tombstone about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday is played by Val Kilmer, and he insists on sticking with Wyatt Earp's posse despite being violently ill from consumption. So while sitting under a tree, coughing up blood, Jack Johnson, one of the other posse members, asked Doc, what are you doing this for anyway? And in response, Doc slowly says, Wyatt Earp is my friend. And Johnson replies, at least in the network TV version, shoot. Shoot, I got lots of friends. And Doc simply says, I don't. And that's determination that's born out of friendship, that's born out of being bowled over by your relationship with someone. Paul never got over what Jesus had done for him, and because of that, he just couldn't be silent. An explosion of joy left his ears ringing for the rest of his life. And I want to be just as deeply amazed at what Jesus did for me. In the next passage, we'll see that because the Lord was so alive to Paul, he is incredibly flexible and yet disciplined in the steps he is willing to take to help others to understand Jesus. The joy of the Lord makes him strong enough to be a slave. So I'll read verses 19 through 27. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So though Paul is truly free, he chooses to make himself a slave to others. The great persecutor of the church was chosen to meet Christ face to face as an apostle unnaturally born. And only the otherwise demeaning term slave could describe his joyful reaction to Jesus. All of what we teach and uphold to one another in this church about our freedom in Christ is true. But it doesn't stop at freedom. For a mature believer there, I think there's a really profound and holy dance between freedom and worship that leads us back to pick up our crosses and to follow Christ down the path that he walked. And carrying our crosses leads us back ever deeper into freedom and praise. This isn't about heroism, it's about an overflow of worship. Evangelism, extending yourself across cultural gaps and suffering are intertwined. Evangelism in particular brings on a kind of dislocation and trying to really relate to different people. And these verses speak very powerfully to me. Supposedly, Garrison Keillor once said, you're never quite as smart in some other country as you are in your own. And as someone who likes to sound smart, this is really hard for me. I am inarticulate, stumbling, weak, and unwise amongst Croats. My deficit of knowledge of their culture, wrong intuition, misunderstanding of subtle cultural cues, and grammar mistakes are always with me. I almost never feel like I'm hitting on all cylinders in an open, wide-ranging conversation in Croatian. But I keep going and do everything so that Croatians can more fully share in the gospel's blessings. And in a place as diverse as here, you can experience this just by crossing the street. Friends of ours, a couple in this body, have befriended an immigrant family from a country that's very much close to the gospel. But it's not easy. Sometimes the family appreciates the help that's given to them. Sometimes they don't. Our friends are building trust, but it's messy and complicated, and they're limited by some of the challenges in their own lives as well. But to me, their lives are an example of this kind of stretching of ourselves towards others. And do you notice that Paul in verse 22 says he does all this to win some? No matter what you read in prayer letters or in missions marketing, know that evangelism is messy. You rarely know what's going on. The person you get most excited about ends up being the least interested, and people who seem to be uninterested come back to you later and tell you great stories about what God did in their lives without you. So, yeah, it's often two steps forward and then one or two or three steps back. And Paul joins this to a discussion of discipline, of sticking it out in these kinds of stretching and pulling situations. There is really a role for discipline in evangelism. I love people, but I need time alone. I need a lot of time alone. So my wife and I, we stretch ourselves to say yes to invitations, to pursue friendships, but while also listening for our own limits and taking the time to be alone. We work at setting our lives up so that we are with people as much as we can and have the energy for. But we do what we can and not what we can't. And I think getting a good sense of your own limits is a big part of growing in fruitfulness. I feel like in saying this, I may be kind of, you know, bumping up against a lot of deep feelings in many of you about the relationship between work and grace, but I am not suggesting that you try harder. I think what God is working in us to do involves a lot more patient endurance than what we're accustomed to, but also a lot less frenzy and a lot less obsession with results than our culture has programmed us to expect. It's about being set free to give ourselves away. Paul never got over what Christ did for him, and that made him determined, but also free to take on the incredible challenge of communicating the gospel across divides. He was free from the manias of his own time. His focus was always on Christ, and I think those things also characterized the early church, and it followed him in this legacy as it expanded throughout the Roman Empire. It's tricky to take a look at the early church. You know, we evangelicals, we don't make the mistake of liberal scholars who, in their search for the historical Jesus, always just ended up finding their own best selves. So they found a peace-loving hippie Jesus or a Marxist revolutionary Jesus or the guru Jesus. But I think sometimes we make a parallel mistake when we take a look at the early church and end up finding the idealized picture of the church we kind of want to be a part of. I had an interesting chance to watch this in a seminary class taught by Chris Armstrong, the former editor of Christian History Magazine. And Armstrong asked a class of mostly youth pastors and church planners what they thought really made the early church keep growing for 300 years. And the answers we gave reflected in a lot of ways our own ideals for our churches. Passionate worship, incredible community, great teaching, clear doctrine, et cetera, et cetera. And Armstrong brought us up short by saying, yeah, that's all great, but how about this? Early Christians cared for each other and outsiders during plagues. Basic palliative care dramatically increases the survival rate of a plague. And this meant that some Christians did things that directly led to their own deaths, but overall the survival rate of the Christian community not only exceeded the general population, but non-Christian friends were deeply affected by the behavior of their believing neighbors. Christians did not abort their children or abandon baby girls, as was customary in Roman society, and rescued babies abandoned by others. There's a host of these kind of arguments, sociological arguments, made by someone named Rodney Stark in a fascinating book called The Rise of Early Christianity. And basically his claim is that early Christianity did not take over the Roman world so much by continual public proclamation of what we so often think of as evangelism, but by the fact that ordinary people lived incredibly distinct lives. The population density in a Roman city was incredibly high, supposedly still not exceeded by almost any cities in the modern world. So in Christian's lives could not help but be readily visible to the lives of those around him. It was really probably the lives of poor, ordinary, usually illiterate believers that fueled the growth of the church so that it doubled in size about every 20 years, generation after generation after generation for 300 years. And these early churches were often a mess in a lot of ways. They often had poor teaching. But what the early church had was, I think, what Paul had. Rock-solid convictions that Christ is the clue, the source, and the goal of history. In a crazy world, they saw everything through Jesus-colored lenses. They shared in his weakness, and they also shared in his powers. And they confronted everyone around them with the ultimate issues of existence. And they did this generation after generation after generation. There's a later Roman emperor named Julian who earned himself the title the Apostate by turning away from the Christian faith that he was raised in. And he sought to restore the glory of paganism. His exhortations are quite revealing of what the behavior of Christians really was like, even into the fourth century. So this is Julian giving a pep talk to some pagan priests. Why do we not notice that it is their kindness to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done most to increase atheism, his name for Christianity? So this is what I want you to do. In every city, establish hostels in order that strangers may profit by our generosity. I do not mean for our own people only, but for others who are also in need of money. For it is disgraceful that while no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans, another derogatory term for Christians, support both their own poor and ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us. Be more like those crazy Christians. So based on Paul and based on the church throughout history, I take encouragement that we do not need to be paralyzed by the fact that Christianity is probably losing its cultural grip on America. It's something to mourn, but something to accept as the new normal. Somehow Christ, the Lord of history, has a reason for bringing the Western world to the point of thinking that the good news is neither good nor news. It is a tough situation today. Tim Keller, a pastor in New York City, says that we don't just need apologetics anymore. We need apologetics for our apologetics. We need to defend the idea that our ideas are even worth listening to. There are fewer and fewer people today in a state of spiritual need like my family was in the 1990s. People who have a regard for God, grew up going to church, but never had really heard the gospel explained clearly, and who needed really nothing more than a direct explanation of it to turn the course of their lives. Today, we more often have to earn the right to be heard. And a good example of this, I think, comes from another pastor in New York City named Christian Rose, who intentionally leads his church to do volunteer work in secular organizations. He explains that if Christian, postmodern, secular New Yorkers are ever going to listen to the gospel, it's going to have to be legitimized in their eyes. So we're not doing mercy ministry to legitimize our message. We're doing mercy ministry because it's a demonstration of the message. And we have seen this awaken people's hearts. In some of our ministries, we're upfront and explicit in preaching the gospel, in soup kitchens, for example. And others, we have to be more patient and build some relational capital first. We've been at the Ronald McDonald House for a couple of months, and I would venture to say that not all the residents there know we are Christians. We didn't come in holding a Jesus Saves banner or wearing church t-shirts. But as conversations are started and relationships are built, it becomes apparent. We're not trying to broadcast it, but just trying to be sincere. We have the right answers to the right questions, like, how do I be saved? But people aren't necessarily asking the right questions. But when we're together with people, they're going to start slowly asking the right questions. This is a huge cultural shift, but the early church also had to deal with a bewildering cultural shift of trying to figure out what it meant that the Gentiles had been allowed into the people of God. And that confused many, even Peter at times. But the early church responded to their sovereign Lord and recognized that the Holy Spirit had been poured out on the Gentiles and that that's clearly what God was doing. They accepted where their Lord was taking them. And so, you know, I was trained in methods of evangelism that sometimes kind of really sought to stay on some comfortable ground with a lot of simple answers so that it could be easy and fun for the whole family. But so when it gets messy and I still deal with this voice in the back of my head, when it gets hard, I think something's wrong with me. I didn't learn it right. I need to go back and, you know, figure out what the right answer was there. But I think we've entered into an age when evangelism as a method or material or media is less and less significant. So to apply what I'm saying by ending with a bunch of tools, I don't think is likely to be as useful. Before I make any suggestions, let me say just this, that, you know, for me, the finest fruit of this sermon would be that the next time you're out with friends and you feel kind of disjointed or off-center or uncomfortable because this is not kind of the conversations you're used to having, and there's a voice in your head screaming, this is uncomfortable, therefore you do not belong here, that you'll instead hear the voice of Jesus saying, I am right here, and this is the place to know me and the joy of my Father. But I do want to mention some areas of both learning and engaging that I think can be helpful, starting from our own hearts, a little bit about our personal lives, and our life together as a community. In terms of learning in your heart, what would it really mean for you to be completely sold on your own product, the whole thing, God, Jesus, the Bible, and even the church? If it's been a while since the beauty and truth of God's plan has been impressed on your heart in a new way, it's going to be hard to be excited to talk about him with others. I am a mess in all sorts of ways, but I am extremely thankful to the Lord that every couple of years, the scales fall from my eyes in a new way, particularly in just realizing how incredibly limited my own cultural perspective is. And every time he does it, I see him as beautiful in a new way. And every time he does it, I realize the problem was never with him. The problem was with me and how limited my view was. So when I'm excited about him, I am excited to talk about him. The problem in our world today is not that Jesus and his ways are no longer relevant. The problem is that a twisted version of Jesus' ways have become so deeply but imperfectly infused into our Western world that it no longer has any idea what it owes him. We assume so many things that would not exist if not for the Jews and then Christ. Appreciation of life in an ordered community that also values the worth of each precious individual. A life marked off by rhythms of rest and work. Redemption for broken people. confidence that the world is ordered enough to make scientific inquiry worthwhile. The list goes on and on. And I think, so in your own personal lives, knowing the big picture of what this world owes to Jesus can make a big difference in facing the anxious blame that it places on Christianity for so many of its problems. So go ahead, do the hard intellectual work. I mean, in this kind of church, there's a lot of people that are really smart. Of learning about his role in history. In terms of engaging your own heart, talk to Jesus about it when you feel a lack of enthusiasm for talking to others about him. I find myself asking him, Jesus, how is it that I'm not really getting how precious you are? Because I don't really want to talk to you about you today. Or where is my thinking wrong and about what you've done for me? In terms of personal learning and moving out from our heart to our relationships with others, it is a very good spiritual exercise to learn how to share the gospel simply. 1 Peter 3:15 tells us to always be ready to give an explanation for the hope that is in us. So if you've never done so, get with a friend, get with someone else, maybe try and figure out a way to really shortly tell the story of what God has done in your life in a way that's easily understandable. And learn or write a brief explanation of the gospel. Today, there are many innovative ways to present the gospel that don't involve little tract-shaped booklets. There are ways you can draw pictures on napkins. There are decks of cards that just have interesting images on them you can use to start conversations. There are a lot of different things out there. And in terms of engaging those around you individually, in your everyday life, every one of you is God's chosen light to your family, to your neighborhood, to your school, to your workplace, wherever he has placed you. So go ahead and just be a real friend to non-Christians around you. This can be unpleasant. Sometimes it means really allowing ourselves to be on other people's turf and to look at the world through their eyes, even politically or philosophically or spiritually. But Paul was willing to become like other people in order for them to understand. God's plan of salvation depends on incarnation. It's just the way it is. If he could bear becoming human, I can bear sitting in a smoky cafe, listening to a friend go on and on about stuff that kind of breaks my heart, and really not being sure how I'm going to bring Jesus into the conversation. Ask open-handed questions of your friends, like, what would it have to happen for a relationship with Jesus to seem appealing to you? And let those answers form your prayers for them. Be a learner. Tell people you're curious to let them tell you how they see the world. In terms of learning as a body here in PBC, I exhort you to become a learning community about the culture right here in the Bay Area, in the same way that missionaries do when they go to a new land. Here are some questions I wonder about, and I don't know the answers to, but I think they have an effect on us. Why do California homes have high fences? Where did that come from? I Googled it and could not find an answer. And what does that do to our relationships with our neighbors? Why is it that both Southern California and the Bay Area are famously secular, sort of liberal parts of the United States, but the gospel's place in the life of Los Angeles is a lot more obvious? L.A., you know, right in the center of L.A. was the birthplace of modern Pentecostalism. Billy Graham really got his start there. Our ministry, Campus Crusade for Christ, came from there. And a host of other movements of God came out of there. And the Bay Area is very different in that way. And in fact, I think we really still need to wrestle with, what does it mean that the greatest monster of the 20th century in American life was Jim Jones, who came from San Francisco? And what does it mean that his church looked evangelical, it looked social, gospel-oriented, and it was multicultural? And what does it mean, do they still do this? What does it mean when you turn on the TV news at night and they say, the news from the best place on earth? Do they still do that? No? Well, whatever. Maybe that went down with the dot-com era. But I mean, think about that. For the longest time, the news from the best place on earth, you have arrived. This is the promised land. There's nowhere else to go. What does that do to us when we hear those messages day after day? This church has such a wealth of thoughtful people who work in enormously influential institutions who are tied into this cultural factory called Silicon Valley. This area excels any other place I've ever seen in terms of excellence, in terms of knowing what it means to work and knowing what it means to play. But I think it doesn't have a soul. God is looking to work through you to confront and unmask that soullessness by your life together in Christ. Learn together also about the kind of steps people go through in coming to Christ in this time and place. Two InterVarsity missionaries recently wrote an excellent book called I Once Was Lost, based on interviews with hundreds of students who have come to Christ in recent years. And they identify a number of thresholds that people are going from on their way from far away from Christ to believing in him. And one excellent observation they make is that people first need to get over a threshold of thinking Christians are worth trusting. But then they need to get over a threshold of becoming intrigued about Christ. And so this, I think, leads us to realizing we need some finesse in our friendships with people to be real friends who are patient, but also a little bit provocative and challenging people to think. Also, engage corporately by making your relationships with outsiders a part of Bible studies and home fellowships. Each person could pick 3 to 5 friends and make regular prayer for and discussion of their needs and hang-ups a part of your time together. And in everything, be patient. There's a saying in mission circles that you are going to way overestimate what can happen in 2 years, but underestimate what can happen in 5. Pick commitments to a volunteer organization, a neighbor, or a group of friends, and stick with it way longer than your intuition tells you should be necessary to see something happen. So I'll close with a charge to you. The joy we yearn to experience isn't going to be found only in one more excellent Bible study or some new spiritual discipline. It is instead to be found in struggling to love people in Jesus' name. Christ's love does not make us slick, and it does not make us full of answers. It instead compels us to love people, to extend ourselves across boundaries. We have seen his beauty, and we want to be with him, and he is out there on the edge of the darkness. Evangelism is really just an act of worship by which we seek to be with the Lord where he is. So may the beauty of Christ so overwhelm us that we love those around us with patient endurance. We have nothing left to lose, nothing left to prove, but so much to gain by being with the Lord out on the edge of the darkness. Thank you.